from WXXI News. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in a viral video this week of a youth football practice. In the video, there are two children wearing full pads and helmets. One is considerably larger than the other. When the practice drill begins, the smaller child attempts to get into position to tackle the larger child. The smaller child appears to be around 7 years old, and what happens next is hard to watch. The larger child lowers his helmet and smashes head-to-head into the smaller child, and the smaller kid is violently slammed back down onto the ground. For a moment in the video, it appears the smaller kid's been knocked out. He is certainly dazed, and the adults in the video are laughing. This video went viral because it was sickening for many people to see, and for many Americans, it's an example of why it's hard to be a fan of football. We know the reality of what happens to the human brain when repeated hits like that one occur. We know the risk to children. The NFL has tried to change the rules and the equipment to make the game safer, but can we, as fans, make a claim that watching football is an ethical way to spend our time, our attention, our money? Look, I'm a Cleveland Browns fan. It's in my DNA. I went to a game when I was 7. It was a playoff game. The Browns went to the playoffs many years ago, and I struggle with this. I am not condescending from the mountain here. I'm talking to myself here a lot because I really struggle with this one, and I am a Browns fan, and I'm excited about the season, but those videos are tough. And then there's the question of the forthcoming World Cup of Soccer. The nation of Qatar is hosting the tournament, and in order to build gorgeous new football facilities, the country has abused human rights and sacrificed the lives of thousands of workers to get the buildings completed. Writing for publicethics.org, MCC Professor of Ethics Jake Vojtovich starts with a question. Should we boycott the 2022 World Cup? He writes, quote, "Nobody really knows how many workers in Qatar have died wrongful deaths in constructing the infrastructure to host the 2022 World Cup. But people have died for our entertainment. How should we, as fans and as players, react to this? Researching and writing this piece affected me much more than I expected. I deeply want England to win the World Cup, but I'm not sure I want them to win this World Cup because I'm not sure I even want them to play. And I can't shake a nagging sense that I should not watch the World Cup. But I also think I probably will watch it. And I'm concerned that if I do watch the World Cup, it's because I'll be ignoring these moral wrongs for my own entertainment," end quote. Vojtovich examines the many thorny issues confronting sports and ethics. Should the players boycott if it's clear that human rights abuses have taken place? If the players do not boycott, should the fans refuse to watch? Who is ultimately most responsible? And we can return our gaze to American football, where many of us wrestle with our love of the sport and our understanding of the risk to the people who play it. Can we justify our fandom? Have recent safety upgrades made the game more palatable? My guest is a professor of ethics who might love sports even more than I do, Jake Vojtovich. By the way, you can read his piece. He's been a contributing writer for publicethics.org. Jake, welcome back to the program. Are you there, Jake? Do we have Jake? Are you there now, Jake? I think I can hear you.
I'm here. I can hear you. Can you hear me?
I can hear you now. Hey, it's a Friday, man.
Ah, great. Excellent.
It's a Friday. We're off to a roaring start. No, this is going to be a really fascinating hour, and I encourage listeners, email me your thoughts on related issues to sports and sort of fandom ethics, connections at WXXI.org, or you can call the program 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Did you always grow up loving sport, Jake?
I did, yeah. Since I was about maybe 10, I started liking sport. I've never been very good at any of it, but it's fun to watch and fun to play.
Who is your EPL team?
I was a Manchester United fan. I gave up on that probably 10 years ago. I'm a very big fan of Paul Scholes and have a poster of him in our living room. But since he retired, I've sort of left that.
You are the first English football fan that I have talked to who is more beholden to a player than a club. Now, Manchester United, I agree there are some ethical problems liking them, just like liking the New York Yankees there are some ethical problems with, or the New England Patriots. But what moved you off of them?
I don't know. I liked the club as much as Scholes. It wasn't, I didn't stop liking them because he retired. But I just, I found other interests. I was playing more rugby. I didn't watch as many games. They also got to be not very good, and that probably contributed. But yeah, I really enjoy watching football, soccer. And it's just quite good fun to do that as a purist and not be invested in one side. So I really enjoy that.
For the rest of the hour, we're going to make Jake suffer by calling football soccer and by calling American football. Just for the purpose of simplicity. And heck, you live in this country now, so you're going to have to get used to that.
I know, it's very tough.
Jake Vojtovich, our guest, who has been a contributing writer for publicethics.org, and I confess, your piece on the forthcoming World Cup really had me thinking again, because Jake, I remember, it feels like it was a few years ago now when Qatar was starting the construction of these stadiums, and you would start to hear these stories, these really horrifying stories. And, so I confess I hadn't thought about that in a while. And until your piece, it was kind of not really at the forefront of my mind, but when World Cup time comes around, I love it. I just love it.
Yeah.
And this one's going to be really, really difficult for me. Do we actually know the dark, awful question of how many people have died? You write in the piece, it's hard to know exactly. Tell me why you think it's hard to know in your research and why it's been so murky.
So one number that you see is 6,500 people have died. That is over-inclusive, because that includes every migrant worker in Qatar who has died in a certain period. I think it's since they were awarded the World Cup. But it's every migrant worker who's died, and that's, died in bed of a heart attack, hit by a bus, every death like that. So it's certainly not the case that all of those deaths are wrongful deaths due to building World Cup infrastructure. Another thing is Qatar seems to be having an infrastructure boom, so there's lots of building that's going on, regardless of the World Cup, that may have happened anyway. But the other problem is that we get the statistics on the deaths from the countries from which these migrant workers come from. And we only have those statistics from, I think, five or six countries. And there are several countries that send lots of migrant workers there. And we don't know how many of their citizens have died. So the number's very murky. And I think sometimes focusing on the number might sort of mislead us from the important thing, because it's clear that some people have died to bring us the World Cup, but it's definitely clear that people did horribly to bring us the World Cup. You have labor camps, reports of people working 100 days in a row, no midday breaks despite the weather getting, the temperature getting to 120 degrees. So these people are being horribly exploited, and it's clear that some of these people who die are dying because they're working these long days. They're exploited. They're living horrible lives to bring us the World Cup, to bring Qatar infrastructure.
Mm-hmm. So even if we don't know if it's 6,000 or 10,000 or 5,000, it's an awful number. It's a lot of people, and it is it is wrongful deaths any way you look at it. And so Qatar itself has not been all that forthcoming. I mean, this is not a nation that's been happy to sort of comply with freedom of information requests, which has only made it harder. And yet they continue apace preparing for the 2022 World Cup here. So what are you going to do here as a fan?
I don't know. So I don't think, I'm not convinced that we should boycott it, but I think we might have to boycott it. There's lots of stuff to think about. And part of the problem is, unless there's a massive fan boycott, it's not going to stop the World Cup happening. So it's not like we're going to stop it. And many of these deaths have happened already. So it's not like we're going to stop this bad stuff happening. There's some talk that an international union, a workers' union, got involved. And there's been some talk that actually this pressure is improving working conditions in Qatar. So there's some arguments that say we should, continue watching it, and this is a good thing. That seems perverse to me. But sometimes it seems like a waste to not watch it because all this bad stuff has happened. But then on the other hand, I think, and this is the thing that really gets me, if we want happening what happened, even though we're not going to do anything practical by boycotting it, we're still saying, oh, this was fine. This was worth it to bring us, you know, heavily entertaining 2 months of football, of soccer. And these people's deaths were okay for that.
Well, thanks to your writing, there's a couple of ideas that I think not only am I benefiting from learning from, but I think listeners will appreciate learning from. The first is the concept of sports washing. How do you define sports washing?
Oh, sports washing, it's usually a bad regime, sometimes a country. Sometimes it's the country through a couple of prominent individuals. They buy a football club or they sponsor a competition, or in the case of Qatar, they host the World Cup. And in doing so, they make people like them. And if you like people, then you're more likely to overlook their, you know, their human rights abuses. And so you're more likely to go on holiday there or spend your money there or whatever. And so it's pretty prevalent in soccer. There's several very big clubs who are owned by either individuals who are part of horrible regimes or you know, horrible regimes that engage in human rights abuses. And what they're doing is trying to make themselves look better to the fans, not by stopping doing the bad things like abusing workers or, you know, extrajudicial killings. They're just trying to make people like them more and ignore all the abuses.
So Qatar seems to be a classic case of sports washing then as they prepare for the 2022 World Cup, yes?
Yeah.
Do you prefer right now, Jake? I mean, if you had your choice, would you like to see them suffer the shame of half the countries saying we're not doing it, and the competition essentially collapses? It ends up sort of a sham competition. The regime is outraged. It's an international embarrassment, all because of a way of standing up against the human rights abuses and the deaths that they've caused. Is that what, even though that seems extremely unlikely, would you like to see that happen?
I think so. I don't know the full extent of the facts or the what's been advised. I know that some human rights campaigns have said there shouldn't be a boycott. Off the top of my head, I can't entirely remember why they said that. I think there were some sort of good reasons not to boycott. There are some bad reasons not to boycott as well, like a loss of money or the idea that FIFA might ban these countries from future competitions. But it strikes me that we need to stop this somehow if we can. And if we can have the World Cup without indulging in all these human rights abuses and without condoning them, then that would be a good thing. And players and national federations are in a position where they can say that. They can stop the World Cup going ahead and saying we're not going to do this. And that seems more immediately sort of impactful than, you know, me not watching the game.
Yeah, and so I think in reading your piece, like two things come to mind for me when it comes to the World Cup. Number one, yes, I think the actual power here lies more with the individual competing teams to say we're not showing up. I mean, if... I was going to say Italy, but they haven't been good in a while. I'm mostly kidding. But I mean, if the Italys and Brazils and the Englands and the Portugals and the Spains of the world, and the Argentinas, if they decided we're not going to be there, they've got more power than you sitting on your couch saying, I'm not turning it on.
Right.
But is that also a way for you to rationalize your own participation in supporting it, even in your own small way?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I think it's really easy to say, oh, I can't do anything. Because it's true. There's nothing immediate we can do to, you know, stop what's going on. So why not just watch the games? I think one thing against that, though, is the whole sports watching thing is bigger than just this World Cup. There's lots of places that try and indulge in it. You know, like I said, lots of top teams are owned by pretty nasty regimes. And I think there can be a sort of practical impact to us saying, no, we're not going to watch the World Cup. And that's, we're saying there's limits to what we'll put up with in terms of sports washing. And there could be some sort of useful practical things there, in that teams will have to, countries will have to, if they want to sports wash, they better sort out their human rights abuses, at least to some extent, for that to be effective. If we say no, there's a limit to what we'll put up with. And one more thing. So Norway might actually boycott. There seems to be a small but not unrealistic chance of Norway boycotting, which would be good because they do have one of the world's best players in Erling Haaland. So there's, well, I don't think there's much chance of England or Spain pulling out, but there's a boycott might happen somewhere.
Why isn't there a bigger movement for this, though? I mean, this one, I guess I'm surprised that there's not at least some more consideration beyond Norway.
Yeah, I think money is obviously one of the big elements. Another element is, and this I worry might influence some of the reporting and some of our views on it. England has bid for the World Cup and not got it a few times recently. So I think there could be some element of sour grapes, and that might undermine the position. You know, people say, you're just boycotting this because you didn't get to host it, or you're boycotting this because you want to host it. Because if there were to be a short, you know, an immediately changed World Cup, then England would be out there because it's got good sporting infrastructure. I think it's probably money, and also it's pretty easy not to take this seriously. I didn't really care or think about this before someone emailed me and said, hey, Jake, would you write this thing for our blog? And then I got into it and was like, this is very bad, and it was horrible. It was a horrible piece to write because I had to confront stuff I'd been ignoring. I think it's just really easy to ignore it, and the World Cup will probably go ahead, and what's the point in England boycotting if everyone else will go there? And you know, yeah, so I think there's probably some element of futility mixed in there.
My guest is Jake Vojtovich, who's a professor of ethics at MCC and a contributing writer for publicethics.org. His most recent piece was titled, Should We Boycott the 2022 World Cup? And I asked him to come on to talk about those considerations, but also the broader questions confronting sports fans generally. We're going to get some of your phone calls coming up here in a moment and some of your emails. But closing the loop on some of these interesting concepts that Jake's work has taught me about. So we talked about sports washing. How about the question of the problem of dirty hands? Can you do your best condensed philosophy lesson, which I found this all very interesting?
So the problem of dirty hands, I think this is the best way of thinking about us watching the World Cup. And the problem of dirty hands is a sort of separate idea. It's the idea that sometimes politicians will have to do really bad things for, like, the greater public good. A classic example is torturing a terrorist to find out some information, which actually probably doesn't work and is ineffective and evil anyway. But that's the sort of example.
But like in the hypothetical example, it's going to work if you do it. Right. I got it.
And you have to condone it and do something that you think is morally evil in order to, you know, save 1,000 lives or whatever. And the problem there is you're doing something evil in order to do something good. And part of the problem, it isn't just that some evil thing is being done, it's that you're doing it and you're being implicated in this bad stuff. And the thought is, you know, we might want politicians who don't mind being implicated in these bad things because it's for the greater good. And I think the way that bears on when we think about the World Cup is we have to think really seriously about our own implications in this. It's not that we're going to end up doing something evil, but we're not going to literally have the blood on our hands. That's on the Qatari government. That's on FIFA. It's not going to be on the players' hands. It's not going to be on the fans' hands. But we are somehow, by watching it, by getting emotionally invested in it, which is something I would, despite myself, probably do, I'm somehow condoning this and saying this is fine, and I'm sort of putting myself in the midst of this nasty moral, you know, nasty moral swamp. And it's unpleasant, and we need to think about, I think the way to think about the World Cup is how much does our involvement matter to us?
It's going to be easier for you when England loses their first two matches in group play.
Yeah, I think I've decided that if I do boycott it, I will at least watch the semifinal and final. Because that would be beyond me, but they probably won't reach that. So
no, they're going to disappoint you, and then you're going to go, well, I was going to boycott it anyway. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I mean, like, we laugh here because it's amazing what we will rationalize. And as cynical as that sounds, you know, Jake might end up in the position. Let's say England goes on the most glorious run they've had since what? When did they win the Cup? 1950? When did they win the World Cup?
66.
66.
50 was our great humiliation.
I didn't mean to alight upon your great humiliation. 1966.
I think we lost to America in that period, which was really bad.
Well.
But 66 was our win.
Okay, so you know, let's say you're on a run that rivals what happened in 66, and you've decided to boycott it. The temptation to say, well, I could watch one match, you know, as opposed to if they crash out in group play, it's much easier for you to say, well, I'm not really interested. I mean, Buffalo Bills fans and Cleveland Browns fans go into this season for the first time in a long time. Both franchises can expect that they're going to be in the playoffs, that they could compete for a Super Bowl, and fans who are now, you know, sort of dealing with, boy, I don't know. I mean, we've seen everything we need to see with CTE. Is this the time for me to walk away from it? But it's harder to walk away when all of a sudden the thing that you've been waiting for is finally happening. That can be very challenging, and I think, Jake, it's tempting to say, well, I'm just one fan. What could I do as one fan? Are my hands that dirty? So comparatively with the problem of dirty hands, how dirty are the hands of one fan, Jake?
That's the problem, isn't it? I mean, how implicated are we? How implicated is the one in the 1 billion fan who watches the World Cup? And I think there's just this, it's so easy to minimize our own moral role in it. But also the thought that keeps coming back to me, the thought that makes me think I should boycott this, is if I watch it, I'm saying I'm okay with this. I'm sort of staking my own moral claim and saying I'm fine with people dying for my entertainment. And that is more powerful than that makes the argument for boycotting it much more powerful than thinking about what impact can I have, rather than thinking what will my boycotting it do to help others or do to others. There's a sort of way of thinking about what will it do to me? What do I say about myself by saying I'm fine watching this?
Wow. A totally different way to think about it, I admit. Do you think, Jake, that you can say, I condemn and don't support the human rights abuses in Qatar that led to thousands of deaths of workers in inhumane conditions, and I'm also going to watch the games, but I am opposed in every way to what happened to the workers. Can you do both?
Maybe. That's what I want to think about. We've still got a year and a half until the World Cup comes along.
But maybe not.
Maybe not. There's also the qualifiers that come up soon. But yeah, I think, can we condemn it whilst also watching it? Yes, but I'm not sure what good that does.
I'm going to grab our first phone call, Rich in Rochester. Go ahead, Rich.
Hello, Evan. How are you doing?
Good, sir.
Yeah, this is a dilemma I think everyone faces. Like, people are dying, and we still watch the sport. And I guess Saquon's, for a lot of people, they're so far removed from these people who are dying. They're not part of their tribe. They don't identify with them. So it can be sort of written off easier for some people. But it's something you got to look at. But this happens in every sport. I look from the NFL, from CTE, to the Colin Kaepernick thing. I mean, I don't like these things, what they're happening, what I think the sport in general stands for, but yet we justify it. I don't know if it's in... We duel with the environment, you know, like, don't dump as long as I can dump. You know, I don't know how we challenge ourselves. I guess it's a constant challenging of ourselves to say, who are we really, and what are we willing to and not willing to do? And I don't know if it's an easy answer. I'm not letting us off the hook in any way. But the reality is, it's just not an easy answer. We like what we like.
Yeah, and the question, I guess, becomes how much does it take for us to walk away from what we like, right, Rich? I mean, how much?
Yeah, I know. I mean, We even make the whole thing a fandom. You're supposed to stick with a team for 80 years because they lose. And if you leave that team, you're this horrible person. No, why can't I just watch a good team? Yeah. So even we take it even to that level. We make this almost a religion, and it's crazy. But we're all hooked on it. It's our drug.
Rich, I appreciate the call, and that last point is something I want to ask Jake about. Thank you, Rich. Is there an element that looks like religiosity with sports fandom?
Maybe. I think there's maybe a more positive way of putting that. You opened this by saying that, you know, the Browns are in your DNA, and just before there was a news bit where the GM of the Red Wings talked about how, you know, next week it's not just that baseball is back, our community is back. There's these deep ties between so being a fan can just be like liking the sport, it can just be enjoying the sport, but more often than that, there's a sort of deeply communal element. And you know, you like going to the games to be with your friends and to watch your team, and it's part of, you know, it's part of what. And sometimes this can be overstating it, but sometimes not. Sometimes it's part of what makes you who you are. You know, you're a Browns fan, or you're a Yankees fan, or something like that. And this can be sort of central to like our identities and who we think of and who we think we are. So that can be a sort of counterweight against the boycott idea, because it's not just me giving up something I like. It's not just me, you know, not eating Klondike bars for a month. It's giving up something that's part of, you know, I am a football fan. If you know, someone asks me what's important to me, I will say, amongst other things, football, soccer. And people, you know, say their particular clubs are important to them. So I think there's, sometimes we can undersell sports. Sometimes we can say that sports are fun or enjoyable, which is true, but there's more to sports than just them being fun and enjoyable. They make us who we are, and they're part of big communal, they're big communal enterprises that go beyond just enjoying what goes on the pitch. And so I think that's really important to keep in mind, and it maybe makes the problem even sharper.
But is there an argument that there is a potential problem, I don't know if moral or ethical is the right word, but a potential problem with fandom that becomes so fervent that, I don't know, people are fighting in the stands. I mean, Jake, that would never happen in the United States, as you know, and it never has, because we're a civilized people. But I'm, of course, kidding here. I mean, this happens everywhere. It happens at Bills games. It happens at Steelers games. It happened in an Indiana Pacers New York Knicks game, famously years ago, with Ron Artest going into the crowd and throwing a punch. And yes, it happens at British football matches. Does that take it to a point where you go, look, you can consider yourself a football fan, but if you are coming to blows with people over the outcome of a game here, we've lost the plot a little.
Yeah, I mean, that's just bad behavior that people justify. You know, they say, "Oh, I'm just going to the game," and I'm, you know, it's all part of that part of their life, and then they try and dissociate it from it. There was a case a few years back in the UK. Some guy, I think he was a surgeon at some big hospital, said something horribly racist on TV in the guise of being a football fan, and it just he seemed to sort of forget himself as this, you know, respected surgeon, and let his football fan nature take over, and that's a really horrible way of putting it, but it is true that some people just see sports as an excuse to get too much into what's going on and to be too tribal about it, and to see themselves not just as enjoying their own team but fighting others. Italy has ultras who can often be there's deep violence with the ultras. And also, a lot of them don't seem to care about soccer. They seem to care about being an ultra, not even being a fan of that club, but being in this group. Yeah, and that stuff's just bad, and we should be, you know, when it descends to violence and things, we should just be rid of it and try and stop that as much as possible. And some fans, I think, should really, when it gets to a certain level, you should really think, do I want to still be a fan of this club? Because that means I'm part of this group.
I want to take Bob from Rochester, going to talk about CTE on the other side of this break, as we turn our attention to American football and the ethics of sports fandom and what Jake thinks about that. Jake Vojtovich is a professor of ethics at MCC and a contributing writer for publicethics.org. And he writes in, among many other things, about ethics and sports fandom. And it's some very interesting, challenging questions for all of us. So let's take that break, and we'll come back to your comments for him next. I'm Evan Dawson. Monday on The Next Connections, former Republican presidential candidate Rick Santorum recently said that Native Americans don't contribute much, certainly not much culture, to American culture. We're going to talk about the reality of Native American culture and what has been contributed. And then a conversation about social media and the law and freedom of expression. Talk with you on Monday. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Closing the loop on the religiosity question, some interesting comments from Hannah, who writes, a folklorist chiming in here, sports plus related rituals emulate the same religious practices that satisfy our basic human need to participate in something bigger than ourselves. Fernando Orejuela has done some really good work on this, and she points to some research that sort of bears this out. I like the idea of looking to things that are bigger than ourselves. I like limiting it to the point where we don't become violent because of it. But I love the notion of caring. I Roger Angel is the greatest baseball writer ever. And 30 years ago, he wrote about how important it is to have something that makes you feel, something that makes you care in ways that go beyond just sort of the day-to-day. And there's real value in that. And there's great value when it becomes a part of community. So I appreciate that, Hannah. It's a great point. Bob in Rochester on the phone. Go ahead, Bob.
Hey, hi, Evan. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm calling more about the American football aspect of this, as that video so clearly showed. My own opinion is, and I know this is mostly about the fandom aspect of it right now, but in the terms of the conversation, but my opinion is that the science is inexorably going in one straight direction. And the more they study the effects of the non-concussive hits, the subconcussive repeated hits, the more they see that those lead to CTE. And I know CTE can only be diagnosed on autopsy, but one interesting study I remember reading about where they interviewed older adults who had played some level of football in their lives. So this wasn't even professional football. And they categorized them by having played under 12 and over 12. And they interviewed them, they were still alive, their families, spouses, loved ones. And they found a very distinct difference in many markers in those who started football younger. Mm-hmm. Impulse control, more easily able to anger, lack of concentration, ability to make good decisions, and a whole range of basic life skills. Mm-hmm. And there was a scientifically significant difference between those who played football and started at a younger age. So, you know, I know they're trying to do things to soften blows and change the rules, but it's inherent in football that there are just numerous hits happening all the time without even any concussion involved. And those have been shown to lead to these problems. So I think in the long run, football's going the way of boxing, and it will fade. It might be way past our lifetimes, but I don't think it will have the prominence it has now.
Well, Bob, I'm grateful for your call. You're actually taking this conversation in a direction that I hoped it would go, which is trying to sort of get ahead of if we can get ahead of where the trends change. And because every generation looks back at previous generations and goes, oh, I can't believe they did this. I can't believe they did that. I can't believe the norms were this. How could they have done that? It's valuable to try to figure out what future generations might say about us, but I don't know if it's possible, but I'm in some ways it might be. And so, so Bob, thank you. Really important points here. And again, I say this as an American football fan. I mean, my cards are on the table here. I am not at all holier than anybody on this one, and I struggle with it. So, Jake, first of all, are you an American football fan now?
I am a Bills fan, but I'm not an American football fan. So I don't really care about football unless the Bills are playing.
Do you like watching the Bills?
Yeah, I enjoy the game, but I feel like I need a – maybe that'll change over the next few years, but I feel like I need a bit of an in and some investment to bother watching for 3 hours. Quite often it bores me.
Okay.
But the Bills, very entertaining.
Okay, that's fair enough. Bob is making some important points here, and I want to hit it from a couple of angles here. First of all, he thinks the science is justifies, or at least asks us to reconsider. Do you think it's a strong argument?
I think so, yeah. And this is a problem not just for American football. It's rugby has the problem. Soccer has the problem. There's loads of players who have issues from CTE to other sort of neurodegenerative stuff because of, you know, heading a football or rugby tackles and things. So it is a problem for lots of sports. I think it's a problem that lots of sports haven't taken very seriously, and they certainly need to, because this is, again, you know, killing people or causing them huge cognitive decline.
And so the rejoinder to that is exactly this email I got from a listener named Andrew, who says they know what they're getting into. Andrew writes, quote, "The American football argument is ridiculous to me. Players know what they're getting into. They make a lot of money. They take on the risk willingly. Why should fans be made to suffer for their choices?" Jake?
I think that's some of that's false. They certainly don't know what they're getting into always. They certainly haven't always known what they're getting into. This CTE stuff, as far as I'm aware, is fairly new evidence, and it's only, you know, we've only known this more recently. They do make a lot of money, but that's only some players. And then we have to question, look, even there's lots of great things about football that don't involve massive head hits. So what is it that we like about football, and what is it that players get into football for? What is it that fans watch football for? And can we preserve as much of that as possible whilst minimizing the risk to players? Because even if they knowingly take on these risks, which I don't think is necessarily the case, but even if they do knowingly take on these risks, how can we get rid of them as much as possible whilst preserving what matters? I think there's a way of being way too conservative and, oh, we can't change anything, which is just wrong.
Okay. And I know that sometimes I probably stretch too much and try to make you the moral arbiter of the universe and give too much power to you, Jake. You're just one man. You're just one writer of ethics. Let me sort of... make the parallel to the question on dirty hands and soccer fandom. So, you know, we talked about if you watch the upcoming World Cup of 2022 in Qatar, knowing that thousands of people died to build those stadiums and that they were, you know, treated horribly and there were human rights abuses, all to put this tournament on. If you watch that tournament, you said, you know, you got to think about it more, but you don't know if you could make the claim that you oppose that, but you're still going to enjoy the games. That maybe you can, you got to think about it more, but there might be an argument that you can't. At the very least, the concern is that in the future, the signal here is that other regimes might be given the green light because Qatar got away with it, right? So so that concern, that quandary is there on the World Cup side. On the American football side, can you make the argument that you support more safety for the players, you support the rules and the equipment that have made the game safer, that you want them to be as protected as best as possible, but ultimately, you know, you care about their lives, but you are going to be a fan of the games and you're going to watch.
I think it might be slightly different because football. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I do think that lots of this evidence about how bad football is for players is moderately recent. So I think there's time and space for improvements, where there can be more safety improvements, there can be changes to the rules, and so on. I think we will we have to at some point ask ourselves the question: look, we've known for so long that there's the chance of serious damage. What have we done about it? And if at some point we can say, oh, we've done nothing and we've known for ages, then maybe we should give up. But I think that we should at least sort of hold out hope that football and other sports, like I said, rugby and soccer both have the same different reasons for this problem, but there is the same problem of serious damage to players. How are they going to change to fix these things? How are they going to try and sort this out? And I know rugby's been doing some work on that, but the soccer, the head of the professional soccer union in the UK, he was accused of washing the blood from his hands and ignoring the problem. And you've got to think at some point, what are we doing to stop this? And when do we reach the stage where so little has been done to help that we can no longer sort of condone this? But I don't know if that point's now or if that point's in the future.
Interesting. Linda in Penfield. Go ahead, Linda.
Hi, Evan. Hello, Professor. Thanks for taking my call. I am a self-avowed, long-suffering Buffalo Bills fan. And I have wrestled with my conscience about being a football fan, from the Colin Kaepernick stuff to the Ray Rice stuff to everything with CTE. And I think with me, it's like with you, Evan, it's in my DNA. I grew up watching football. Mm-hmm. Yeah, my father taught me all of the different aspects of a slot receiver and a wideout. I mean, I know all that. And I've said to myself, well, I'll stop watching football when the Bills win the Super Bowl, but, you know, it's going to be awfully tempting to not keep watching.
Yeah.
But the reason, the other side of my brain loves to watch football because these athletes can do things with their body that I could never do. And it's akin to watching a ballet performer or a gymnast,
yeah, yeah,
that they can do these physical skills and, you know, flip upside down and catch a ball. And I watch it for, I guess, the art of it too. And, you know, the same reason I watch golf. People ask you, well, how can you watch golf? It's because this guy can hit this golf ball 400 yards, and I certainly can't. And there's something that, you know, I can admire in that. So, anyway, thanks for taking my call.
I appreciate it, Linda. And that last point, I think, it really is true. I mean, there's something beautiful about what athletes can do at the highest levels. I mean, I watched Damian Lillard last night do some things with a basketball that – I mean, it was just gorgeous. It was like watching poetry. It was like watching a true artist do things that very few people on earth could do. And I loved watching it, and it was amazing. Similarly, who is that awful? Oh, it's Arsenal. I mean, they're awful. Nobody likes Arsenal. But they have – I'm looking at Rob through the glass. Our engineer is one of the biggest gooners in town, and that's okay. Who is the guy who scored that gorgeous goal on the cross? Bamian? Yeah, but Linda's right. There were some really amazing things that happen that make your jaw drop. I hope it's not. I hope it's not Emmett Smith Rowe. Is that right? But I hope it's not the big hits that nearly take people's heads off that make you that make you so excited. I hope it is the artistry and the beauty of it. What is it for you, Jake Vojtovich?
There is the artistry, but sometimes it is the big hit. But what I was thinking about this earlier, and when I used to play rugby, it wasn't the big hits where we both got hurt in the hits that I enjoyed. It was the big hits that were sort of skillful and smooth, and they were executed at very little pain to myself because they were well executed. And same as when I watch these games on TV, it's the ones that it's not the ones where there's a horrible clash of heads and one person stands up because he got lucky. It's the big hits where someone skillfully takes someone else out or someone intercepts something. And I think that's the, at least to me, that's the thing that I value in in the sort of physical aspects of these sports, the players doing things powerfully and physically, but it's not the sort of arbitrary head banging.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I don't think anyone's into the arbitrary head banging, apart from in a sort of gladiatorial Roman way. And I think we can get rid of a lot of that. It is important that we still keep the fact that football involves players pushing themselves to physical limits and doing fantastic things that we can't do. And we still want that. And we still want the good violence. But how can we get rid of the bad, unintended, nasty aspects of the good violence while still maintaining those,
Right. And your question, it seems to me, is it's reasonable to give the sport more time to really try to fix this, and it's reasonable for us to eventually conclude it's not good enough. But you're not sure we're there yet. But you think those considerations have to be made as time goes on. Fair?
Yeah, that's roughly my view as a relatively new American football fan. Yeah.
But I mean, sports in general, where there's risk to head injury that can be so catastrophic. And I also think about Bob's call, Jake, and I think it's interesting to try to figure out what future generations will look back and say. I mean, certainly future generations will look back and they'll be like, my God, the energy consumption. What were you all doing? Why did you do that? How could you be so reckless? I think that's obvious. I think there's many other things that are sort of debatable. And that's one of the reasons why I need to be more humble. I think about even modern progressives who can be really self-assured that they are living the best lives and wanting to change the world for the better. They would probably be surprised if we can skip ahead a couple generations. People will look back on all of us and say, you monsters in certain ways. It will happen to all of us. And I think there is something that is beneficial to try to figure out what that might be derived from. Do you think it's possible, Jake, to like look ahead and say, we're going to try to predict what 50, 100 years from now, people are going to look back with horror at what we commonly did as a society? Is that doable?
I think that always happens, right? We always look at past societies and think, oh, they did these things and they were really bad. I think eating meat will probably be our...
Yeah, the level of meat consumption
moral,
at least.
Moral, yeah.
Yeah, that'll probably be there.
Which I do, yeah.
Which I eat meat, yeah. I mean, right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, I mean, it you're right. In sports, that will happen too. Sports evolve and change. And like soccer, no one passed for the first 50 years. They just ran at goal and there were 10 attackers and a goalkeeper and things. These sports will change and improve sometimes, and sometimes get worse, sometimes get better, but they are fluid. And I think sometimes we can be too sort of committed to the sports of our youth, where that's what it was like when we were growing up. So any change is just getting rid of everything that was worth watching in football, when actually that's quite often not the case. And we can improve things and enjoy ourselves more and kill fewer players.
Yeah, I mean, certainly, obviously, we look back at gladiatorial arenas. I mean, the Roman Colosseum draws millions of people every year because people want to see this fascinating but sort of horrifying place that signified what entertainment was like, a couple thousand years ago. Well, maybe eventually we put American football in that category. Maybe we put a lot more in that category. Boxing. I mean, I already sort of feel that way about... What UFC? I mean, I just can't do it. I cannot do it. I'm not saying they're not amazing, and the individual athletes are amazing, but I can't watch it. I can't do it. Maybe football gets there. Who knows? I think it's interesting to try to think ahead, just to ask ourselves what we can tolerate amongst ourselves. Last question for you comes from Scott, who says, can the global community reschedule or relocate the World Cup to a country that previously held the event, such as South Africa?
I think so. Part of the problem is what is the World Cup? And it seems to be FIFA are in charge of running the World Cup. And maybe there could be a breakaway tournament, but there would be questions of legitimacy and what it is. I think this would require action from FIFA, and FIFA are not a particularly nice organization. There were some protests against the Qatar World Cup by the Norwegian players, and a few other teams took part, and FIFA said they weren't going to punish these players because FIFA have always believed in free speech. And if you know anything about FIFA, you know that's entirely false, and they're a sort of morally bankrupt, horribly corrupt organization that probably won't do anything to help. It would be nice if there was some move to have an alternative, but I can't really see that happening. So yeah, it is a shame, but it would be great if we weren't in this position in the first place, because it was probably predictable, and even if it wasn't predictable, we knew 6-7 years ago that there were lots of people dying, and FIFA did nothing. So it's a shame, but they are awful.
Yeah, I mean, 10 seconds, Jake. I don't think there's anything that's going to save FIFA's reputation long term, unless something bizarre and unexpected happens. Do you agree?
Yeah, it would. I mean, there are some democratic elements in there, so maybe they could change at some point. But yeah, they're a horrible lot.
Yeah, quite corrupt. Jake Vojtovich is a professor of ethics at MCC and a contributing writer for publicethics.org. His new piece, Should We Boycott the 2022 World Cup? Thanks for making us think on this Friday afternoon. That's enough thinking for me. I'm off to my weekend. But thank you, sir. I always appreciate it, Jake.
Thanks, Evan.
Just an outstanding thinker and a really fun person to talk to. Our thanks to Rob Braden, Megan Mack, Emma Ray Stein. I'm Evan Dawson. I hope you have a wonderful weekend. And we're back with you Monday on member-supported public radio.